Greetings, everybody. This is Brian Therrien here with Carl Osterhout. Carl, how are you today?
Pretty good. How about yourself, Brian?
Good, good. Carl, we have an audience that's going to really love to hear what you have to say. Thanks for spending a little bit of time with us. Well, although that might be a double-edged sword, because if we're going to talk about getting denied disability today, and nobody really likes to hear that, but there is hope.
Has been known to happen, though.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's like, why did I get denied? I did everything right. So, and you have a particular area of expertise that's intriguing about getting some of these fixed. So, you know, the general work, Carl, that we cover, as you most likely know in our courses, you know, why people get denied: lack of medical treatment, absent of a treating physician, or sometimes people actually exaggerate and, you know, they get busted, I guess, for lack of a better term. Lack of current medical records, etc. So, but what happens when people get denied is what I would like to go through with you. And you've been doing this since, what, 1984? Thousands of cases? I read somewhere in some of your work, like 15,000 cases you've done?
Well, it's probably, yeah, that's an old number by now. Yeah, somewhere in that, probably more like 18, you know, after a few years have gone by. And you know, of course, that included managing a 10-person staff at my old law firm where I was a partner. And, you know, and then since 2000, I've been on my own. So a few less cases in those earlier years.
Mm.
But, you know, we've kind of built up it, again, to the point where, you know, we're doing, you know, something like a volume of practice on a regular basis in a normal-sized staff after kind of working all by myself for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm. And actually, you started in the industry as a non-attorney, right?
Well, yeah, I was hired at my previous law firm as a first-year evening law student. So I was, you know, back then, I think we were just called like law clerks or something like that. Nowadays, I guess I would have been called a paralegal or an administrative assistant. But yeah, that's right. And
mm-hmm.
This was the stuff that Social Security disability cases was what I was hired to help the attorney with that I was going to work with. And something like 6 weeks after I started working for that employer, the associate attorney I was supposed to be working with suddenly decided to leave and go back to his hometown, and so that kind of left me with learning a lot real fast, which I was happy to do. It was something that I kind of took to pretty early on. You know, pretty much right from day one, I kind of liked the clients I got to work with and
mm-hmm.
the work itself a lot.
Mm-hmm. It's rewarding work when you can get somebody some financial and medical insurance, financial relief. Okay, here's where I'd like to start. You know, from our perspective and what we do is, you know, is we educate members that come through that, you know, you can do different ways in which you can file on your own, or you can use representation, explore both, make your decision as a short story. And then from there, once somebody files and they get denied, can you walk us through that process, you know, specifically to start with? When somebody submits an application and, God forbid, they get back the denial letter, what's their next step?
You're talking about initial denial, I
guess. Right.
Right. Okay. Well, of course, that's different in different states right now. In where I practice in Pennsylvania, we are part of a program or a model that's being tried out to eliminate what is typically the second step. And in 40 states across the country, the second step after the claim is denied initially is to file what's called a reconsideration of that claim, which is essentially a resubmission of the case to somebody different at the state agency or at the Bureau of Disability Determination. In Pennsylvania, rather than that going to that second step, the second appeal, or I should say first appeal, really, following the initial denial, is directly to a hearing in front of the administrative law judge. And the reason that's being tested out is that, you know, statistics consistently show that, you know, a request for reconsideration pretty much across the board is going to result in another denial about 90% of the time. And even Social Security at some point acknowledged that there's really not that much point to it. So the idea is that if this model works, then the resources and people and time that get applied currently to reconsideration decisions, in theory, go into making better initial decisions. In other words, if there's more time to spend on an individual case at the initial level, then in theory, more of the deserving cases will be awarded in the first place rather than, you know, at some further point along the line. So,
and in some states, would it be accurate to state that this could speed the process up if you're taking out the recon at the state level?
Well, you know, it's funny, there's so many variables because that's going to depend on, usually anyway, whether we're talking about a rural or an urban area.
Mm.
So for instance, here in Pittsburgh, right now, the delay from when a hearing is requested to when it's actually scheduled is about 16 to 18 months. You know, so compared to maybe some other area where you're only waiting 8 months for a hearing, it might end up being about the same.
Okay.
But you're right, in theory, certainly if you just compare Pennsylvania to itself, clearly claimants in Pennsylvania are getting their hearings faster than they would, in Pennsylvania.
Okay.
It's just, it's sort of hard, you know, as a general rule to say that just because there's, you know, a number of variables. But, yeah, I mean, in theory, again, Social Security is saying, well, we'll spend a little bit more time and more people and more energy, et cetera, on these initial determinations so that the correct decision's made the first time around, and then without a reconsideration, probably in most circumstances, the person's going to be sitting in front of the judge at least somewhat sooner than they would have if they'd had to go through that second step.
Okay. So when you go in front of the administrative law judge, the ALJ, you know, somebody could go in, represent themselves, and they could go in with, you know, somebody that's experienced, either an attorney or a representative, and if they were to get denied at that level, whether they get there via the state or whether they go there directly, then what's the next step?
All right, so we're just skipping the hearing level altogether and kind of going to the appeals beyond that. Is that, do I understand you correctly?
Well, no, I'd like you to walk me through it. So if you're at the ALJ and,
yes,
and you go to that level and you present your case and it's denied at the ALJ, or is there more to it that you can share with us about?
Well, no,
about
I just want to make sure. So we're not really talking about what happens at hearings and stuff. We're kind of going on the negative assumption for the purpose of this discussion that the ALJ denied the claim, so we can talk about the appeals after that.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Once, regardless, of course, of whether the claimant was represented or not, and regardless of whether the representative, if there was one, wishes to go forward with an appeal, the claimant certainly has the right to do that, whether, you know, the representative intends to help them with it or not. Much like the request for hearing, for instance, the local office must help a claimant file that appeal if they don't have the assistance of an attorney. And that appeal from the judge's decision, the ALJ's decision, is going to be to the last sort of line of defense, so to speak, within the Social Security Administration, which is the Appeals Council. The Appeals Council are a body, I think, of about 24 administrative appeals judges who sit in Falls Church, Virginia. I don't remember the numbers exactly, but I believe the Appeals Council gets somewhere in the neighborhood of about 120,000 appeals filed to it per year.
Wow.
And this is, you know, probably only about one-fifth of the ALJ denials that are issued every year. So,
what about the other four-fifths?
Well, a lot of those people, a lot of people who are denied by judges, by ALJs, don't appeal.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, that's going to be a combination of bad advice, you know, not knowing what appeals rights are, and of course, cases that shouldn't be appealed because the decisions are, you know, either correct or at least defensible.
Okay. So is that where the bad advice could come in? Somebody could say, well, you know what, your case, you could appeal it, but I don't think your case is strong enough?
Well, obviously. In my experience, that bad advice tends to come from a couple of sources. Obviously, claimants usually anyway have a social network of friends or whatever that they know, and there's a kind of diner wisdom is what I call it.
I like that.
That tells people to give up if the judge has turned them down. But worse than that, I hear a lot of that, usually secondhand, but sometimes directly from attorneys, where, you know, claimants have been denied by ALJs and their attorneys have told them that they have no chance. Now, that doesn't mean they're wrong automatically, of course, but what I find troubling about that is that at least, and again, my sample is only the attorneys that I know around here. I'm going to assume, though, that, you know, this is fairly typical, and that is that, you know, there's a lot of attorneys in my area here who do Social Security cases who don't appeal anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in my opinion, they don't have the experience or the basis, you know, in knowledge or wisdom or anything to give an opinion one way or the other to a claimant about what their chances on appeal are, because in essence, what I would say to them is, how would you know? Because you don't do that.
Yeah.
And so, what one of the things that, when, you know, I mentioned leaving a law firm 7 years ago, and one of the premises of that for me was that I thought that I would be able to get into conversations with at least some of these attorneys to convince them that, you know, in a nice way, that, you know, since they didn't do that and they obviously weren't interested in doing that and probably weren't ever going to be interested in appealing unfavorable ALJ decisions beyond that level, then, you know, why not let me take a look at it? Because this is something that, you know, partly from the volume of my old practice, but also my native interest, you know, I got a lot of exposure to over the years.
Which is where we get into your area of expertise here.
Right.
Okay. Well, this is intriguing. So, message to members, when you're out looking for an interviewing, as we call it, representatives, you should certainly ask these questions about, you know, what somebody does at the appeal level. Okay. Right? That'd be a fair question to ask, wouldn't it, Carl?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think that's more than fair. I mean, nobody's going to be able to say ahead of time, you know, exactly what they're going to do. That wouldn't be fair either. I mean, to promise a client, oh, yes, I will appeal, I mean, that's not even necessarily honest, because, you know, that's always a function of what are the facts of a given case. But I think the questions, I mean, I should say questions, you know, of a general nature along the lines of, well, do you have, you know, an appeals practice? Do you have cases that you've taken to the appeals council and to federal court, and maybe even questions about, well, what percentage of unfavorable decisions do you appeal, and
sure,
in a kind of general way, what is the prospective attorneys or representatives' track record in appeals, I think can tell you a lot. I mean, they're not going to be able to say, you know, anything along the lines of a guarantee or a promise, But I think that tells you a lot. For instance, if someone like me tells you that, I appeal 80% of the ALJ denials that I get, at least to the appeals council.
Yeah, I always, in our work, what we've learned is to, you know, educate a member that comes through is to, you know, even in the early stages, if they're just applying, is to ask how many cases have you had just like mine, and how many have you won. So in this instance, it would be a slight variation. You know, how many ALJ appeals have you had, and how many have you won?
Yeah.
Now, is there anything that's condition specific here? Like for, you know, I'll use lupus as an example. Yeah, I meet a lot of young ladies with lupus that are not 25 or 30 yet that have, you know, been denied 2-3 times. And the same with fibromyalgia, because it's drastically misunderstood. But is there anything in this process that is that you can comment on about being condition-specific, or is it, you know, again, back to proving that you just can't work and those conditions are a key ingredient to that?
Well, let me change the question a little bit to suit something I think that needs to be clear, all right? And that is, you know, what's the difference between an appeal and a claim? When you're in front of the judge, when you're in front of the ALJ, whether you're with an attorney or not, you are presenting your claim. You're saying, I am disabled and here's why, obviously, in essence. And you know, submitting evidence, etc. That's a claim. Well, let's say the judge denies it. So now the claim has been denied, and what you do at that point when you step off to the next level, which is the appeals council in this case, is you are appealing the denial of the claim. And I'm not sort of being picky here. There's an important point. When you take that case to the appeals council, you're not presenting your claim anymore. You know, in a weird kind of way, you're not even arguing that you're disabled anymore. What you're arguing, hopefully successfully, is that the judge made significant errors, either of fact or in his application of the law, based on the information that he knew at the time of the hearing, that would justify, you know, overturning his decision altogether, or second best, sending the case back to the judge to reconsider it in light of whatever corrections, you know, have been pointed out to him by the appeals court.
Mm-hmm.
And I get the reason why I used your question as an opportunity to step off into that is that it's very misunderstood. Okay, a lot of people think that if the judge denies you, that, well, what I'll do is I'll get a better letter from the doctor, or another letter from the doctor, or more evidence from, you know, the doctor. And except for in very rare instances, you're not going to be permitted to do that. So that what this emphasizes is the importance of doing a good job, a thorough job of documenting the claim, whether it's lupus or fibromyalgia or whatever it is, to the judge, because the fire that we want to hold his feet to is that evidence was submitted. You know, the rheumatologist did document the trigger points, for instance, or the Rh factors do show frequent flare-ups of the lupus, for, you know, just as examples. And so, kind of long way around to the answer to your question is that a case that is properly documented to the judge and that evidence is ignored, that's, you know, the essence of a case that has good prospects on appeal to the appeals council or to federal court. So we get asked to look at a lot of ALJ denials by a number of attorneys around, you know, my neck of the woods here. And one of the things that I noticed pretty early on doing this is that while in many respects Social Security disability practice is nothing like rocket science, there are certainly many ways to not do it well. And so I guess the reason, you know, I wanted to say something about this early on, Brian, and I guess I kind of twisted your question around as an excuse to say it because, you know, frankly, you know, for those clients who I am representing for the very first time at the appeals level, and, you know, probably 15% of my practice comprises that, you know, referrals from attorneys or folks like you, there's nothing I can do at that point about what has or has not been done with respect to documenting their impairments. You know, whatever mistakes they made, if they were on their own, or mistakes that were made by the previous representative or omissions or whatever, in an appeal format, they're written in stone. You know, the only thing that you can hold to the judge's feet to, you know, the only fire you can hold his feet to is the one you built. Okay, and if something's missing, it's basically for appeal purposes, it's as though it doesn't exist.
Okay, let me see if I got this. And, you know,
I kind of jabbered a lot about that.
No. You know, it's like, how do you know to ask the question if you don't know what the question is?
Right? Yeah.
So that's why we do this. So what I see here at the appeals level is whatever the case is and what's in the case, the components of the case, they remain the same, right?
Yes.
Okay. So if what you look at when you go through your work, and anybody that would do this type of work, would be if the ALJ had committed some type of a significant error or possibly overlooked something, and that your argument actually is, well, listen, the case was put together, right? And this person should have been awarded benefits, and here's why. Is that correct?
Right.
Okay.
That the judge, I mean, the most common errors that I see judges make are either glossing over or ignoring altogether significant evidence. We have several judges from my area, for instance, who mischaracterize evidence. They will take evidence that is clearly treating source evidence and call it something else, and then not analyze it appropriately. These are kind of nitpicky in a way, you know, what some people might call, and I think some judges think, are quote-unquote technicalities.
Okay.
But, you know, the Social Security program is a regulatory program. Social Security, the Commissioner of Social Security has virtually unfettered authority to rewrite regulations pretty much anytime it wants. I mean, Social Security could say tomorrow that, you know, for instance, they could change the medical vocational guidelines. All right, tomorrow.
Without political process.
Correct. Now, there's a process, but it's not political. They wouldn't have to get anybody to vote on it. Now, they'd cause a lot of squawking, et cetera, and they might back down if certain political people were interested, but the bottom line is they have a lot of authority. Their authority, their discretion, I mean, to make these changes is very respected by courts, for instance. Most of the lawsuits that have been brought when, you know, alleging that the government improperly changed its regulations, most of them have been unsuccessful for this reason. Point is that because of that, when an ALJ fails to even follow the regulations or apply the correct legal standard in a case that's clearly stated in the regulations, and I see that a lot more often than what you would ever think. You know, this is the kind of argument that we make a lot. We don't argue in federal court, you know, my client's sick and they need the money.
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, that's what you argue to the judge. And then beyond that, it's kind of dry. You know, clients, you know, sometimes want to see the brief, and I always send it to them, and then they call up and say, well, gee, you know, why didn't you tell them about, you know, how I throw up every morning or something like that? And my answer is, well, you know, that's not really the point we're making. You know, that's not that the evidence is unimportant. It's just that what we're, you know, the rose, so to speak, that we're trying to pin on the judge, you know, is this, you know, big mistake they made in overlooking a piece of evidence or not applying the correct regulation, not so much, you know, sort of, for lack of a better word, you know, appealing to heartstrings, so mm-hmm. to speak, of the particular federal judge that our case is in front of.
Mm-hmm. Okay, here's two other areas of questioning that I know sure. that the people, the thousands of people that will listen to this are most likely thinking about. And one is, how long do I have to go back and see if I can actually appeal the denial decision at the ALJ level? If somebody has not done this, how long do they have?
In most cases, that's going to be 60 days from the date of the ALJ's decision plus the 5-day mailing period, so basically 65 days.
Okay.
I say in most cases, meaning like 99% of the cases. There are good cause exceptions. You know, a client can always, under the appropriate circumstances, argue that they were unable to appeal. You know, I've had a few cases, you know, for instance, like if someone's in the hospital or really sick or something like that. Obviously, over the years, I've represented a few people who were mentally challenged or emotionally challenged in a way that made it difficult for them to file the appeal on their own. And that's not a gimme by any stretch of the imagination, but in a number of cases, we've been able to argue that their failure to file in time should be forgiven. But I'd say anybody who's listening to this and has understood, you know, even one-third of what I've been saying probably understands that, you know, right there on the ALJ decision is, you know, the appeal rights, which state, you know, very clearly, you know, that you have 60 days.
And you can only go in front of the ALJ once, correct?
You mean once?
Well, okay, you have your original. Here's where I want to get clarification. We meet people daily that say, I've been denied 5, 6, 7 times. Right?
Yeah, I know.
So I'm trying to figure out where they all are.
Well, when a person says that, in my experience, that usually means that they've applied 3 or 4 times,
okay.
They've been denied 3 or 4 times, and maybe one of those times they went in front of a judge and got denied there, too.
Okay.
The way to think of this appeal process is kind of like a ladder, all right? You know, the initial claim is the first rung on the ladder. In most states, the request for reconsideration is the second. ALJ level is the third. Appeals counsel is the fourth. And let's just keep it simple and say federal court is the fifth, all right? Now, let's say a case goes up to federal court, and the federal court decision is favorable. Most cases, if the federal court finds in favor of the claimant and grants, the arguments made by the claimant, the case is going to be sent back for rehearing. All right. So basically, now you go back down 2 rungs to the ALJ level.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's say the worst thing happens and you get denied again. And here we go again, okay, to the appeals council, the federal court. Let's say federal court remands it or sends it back again. And that's happened. You know, I've had cases that have been sent back by district court 3 or 4 times. And so, you know, that's one case being denied, you know, whatever, 5, 6, 7, 8 times. Most clients, when they say they've been denied 4 or 5 times, usually mean that they've filed 3 or 4 or 5 times and gave up after that first level of appeal.
Okay.
That makes sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Yes, it does. Really makes perfect sense. So somebody's beyond that you know, that 60-day window, then their best chance to pursue their benefits would be to file again. Is that correct?
Probably.
Yeah.
I mean, if it's not been that long beyond the 60 days, you know, for instance, if it's only been, you know, 65 or 70 or 90 or something like that, it might be possible under the right circumstances to get the time period waived.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, in general, I'd say, you know, because, you know, clients have to understand this, that, you know, they have to take action, you know, at least I think in most cases, if the judge has denied their claim, if at all possible, for them to have someone go over it who really does specialize, and we're not really allowed to use that word in my business, but I'll use it anyway with the caveats, you know, specializes or emphasizes an appeals practice.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, I'm one of those people. I mean, there are definitely several other attorneys throughout the country that, in fact, there's several that only do appeals,
mm-hmm.
don't even do administrative claims, just handle appeals for other attorneys and such. So I would say, you know, any claimant in the position of, you know, looking at who's gotten an unfavorable ALJ denial, if at all possible, you know, what does it hurt, you know, to have someone else look at it? They
sure.
may, in fact, get the same answer, but it's unlikely they'd be getting the answer from somebody who does as much appeals work as some folks like I do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I'd say there's a pretty clean split of people that come through that, you know, have already chosen representation, and, you know, and half of them are pretty much have gone down to the local, you know, somebody local, and because they're comfortable with them and have chosen them. And then the others have chosen one of the primary ones that are out there on, you know, on the net and heavily advertised.
Uh-huh.
But I guess the message that I want to send out to people is that, you now know some good questions to ask, you know, at the federal appeal level, and Social Security does allow you to certainly explore and interview, and if you choose to, switch. So the consideration here is one can certainly do that, whether they speak with you or somebody else. So, well, this has been really good information, and I know that you're a little tight for time today, and I certainly want to respect that, and thank you on behalf of our members that are in quest of their benefits. So I truly appreciate that. Anything that you can think of in closing that you'd want to share with us for pieces of advice?
Well, again, you know, I guess the way that, you know, the sort of one of our marketing points, I guess you might say, with claimants is that everybody we've talked to, everybody, you know, by definition, really, you know, has been denied. I mean, with very few exceptions. I mean, we do talk to a few people before they've even filed or something like that, and we'll talk to anybody, but by and large, we're getting contacted by people who've been denied at some level of their case. And while we don't want to ever minimize the stress or the heartache or whatever that this causes the claimant, you know, we're used to that. All right, we're not going to panic, and we, you know, we want the opportunity to, especially in these federal cases or appeals cases beyond the judge level, to at least, you know, explain why an appeal won't be successful. You know, it might not even be a lot of the time so much that, you know, the previous attorney is incorrect. It's just that they're, you know, I think attorneys, all of us, and I'm probably included sometimes, are guilty of, like, rushing to just telling clients, you know, what to do as opposed to, you know, why to do it. So, you know, we are, and the client deserves, I should say, you know, that opportunity to ask questions or to have things explained to them, not so much so that they'll like it, because they probably never will. I've never asked a client to be happy with an unfavorable decision when we've gotten one, or when they've already gotten one, but that, knowledge at least helps sort of understand the process and how, you know, you kind of started out this interview talking about, you know, people kind of that sort of eternal question of, well, why was a claim denied? And most of the time, not necessarily any way to answer that, you know, because it would be sort of asking to read the mind of the judge. But we tell people, you know, that there's no reason to give up until you know why you are. Sometimes, you know, the answer to that question, why this happened, is frankly that's just what happens sometimes. You know, you do everything you can, and judges don't always agree with everything that we bring before them. But I think that helping clients sort of understand what all of their options are, as opposed to just the option, you know, for instance, we might be trying to push down on them, I think is important, and hopefully we can live up to that. You know, we've been very, and not to just tout us, because like I said, I'm not the only attorney that takes this position, that, you know, somebody who has a strong appeals practice is somebody who kind of understands how to think forwards and backwards in these cases, in my opinion, in a way that's very valuable to claimants, and frankly, a little bit frightening to ALJs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was thinking as we were going through this, I was going to say, you know, this is very, it sounds very competitive is probably the most polite way to put it.
Aggressive.
Yeah, sure.
Right. And I don't apologize for that. You know, I think it's part of being professional that we can offer, you know, a full service,
mm-hmm.
not just, you know, see how it goes and, you know, and worry about later. I mean, the appeals perspective, and I give CLEs to attorneys on this stuff all the time. You know, and the point I make is that you may never take an appeals case, and that's up to you. That's everybody's individual choice, what kind of work they want to do in their practice. But not knowing, you know, what these federal court cases are saying, you know, not knowing what the case law precedent is, in my opinion, is at best unprofessional and at worst, borderline malpractice, because these cases, you know, the federal level cases are, you know, precedent. You know, they are authoritative in these claims, and the judges know that.
Mm-hmm.
And the judges also know which attorneys appeal and which ones don't. No one ever sort of exactly talks about that, but, you know, in those moments when the crack opens just a little bit and somebody says something like that, I know for a fact that the attorneys who have a track record of aggressively pursuing their clients' appeal rights do better in front of these judges than the ones who kind of take a more lackadaisical, let's say, attitude toward that aspect of their practice. No doubt whatsoever in my mind about it.
Because there's a sense that this guy or gal is not going away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. Exactly.
Yeah. That's cool.
There's some value to be in a pain you know where.
Yeah. Good. Well, awesome. Well, thanks again on behalf of everybody. I appreciate your time, and keep up the good work down there in Pittsburgh, Carl.
Anytime, Brian.
Okay. Great.
All right.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm.